content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with an article today from AARP, the Bulletin, about your health, and it's the dangers of the sugary drink trend. A daily soda habit is more harmful than you think, and here's why. From designer sodas and fresh-pressed juices to bubble teas and chocolatey frappes, we have more options to suck through a straw than ever before. Creative non-alcoholic drinks are all the rage, often matching the latest cocktails in their complexity. Consider the Spring Fling, offered at Utah-based Swig, one of the new old-fashioned soda shops popping up of late. It's made with Dr. Pepper, vanilla, strawberry puree, and coconut cream. But this isn't a healthy trend. Guzzling sugary beverages of any kind puts you at greater risk for weight gain, insulin resistance, and type 2 diabetes. Drinking calories is not natural. It was never part of a human being's evolution. In fact, sipping down sugary drinks may be more harmful to your health than chowing down on a candy bar, and here's why. They turn into fat fast. A typical healthy person has about 5 grams of glucose, a form of sugar, circulating in his or her blood. A 20-ounce bottle of cola contains 65 grams of sugar, 5 times as much as a typical glazed donut. When you drink a sugary beverage, it enters your bloodstream and raises your glucose levels very quickly, far faster than if you took in the same number of calories from a solid food. When your body suddenly has more sugar, more blood sugar, that it can use for energy, it converts this excess glucose into body fat. Worse, even though sugary beverages are loaded with calories, your brain doesn't recognize drinks as food. Calories in liquid form do not really produce satiety. So even as it floods you with sugar, a soda won't trigger the hormones that tell you to stop eating. They come dressed as healthy. The belief that certain drinks are healthy can cause people to forget about their sugar content. A great example of this is store-bought orange juice. It's an ultra-processed food and has as much sugar as soda. And for some people, it can cause the same sugar spikes. Same goes for sweetened coffees, fruit smoothies, or sports drinks, which contain 34 grams of sugar in a 20-ounce bottle. The American Heart Association recommends adults consume no more than 6 teaspoons, 25 grams, of added sugar per day for women, and 9 teaspoons, or 36 grams, for men. And that includes all the sugars snuck into the breads, sauces, and prepared foods that you eat. They may shorten your lifespan. The threat of diabetes and obesities weren't scary enough, if they weren't. Long-term consumption of sweet beverages may also increase your risk of dying from heart disease and certain cancers. Harvard researchers found sipping drinks sweetened with sugar to be associated with a moderately higher risk of breast cancer or colon cancer. They also discovered that for every additional sugary drink a person consumed, on average per day, the risk of dying from heart disease increased by 10%. Now here's 5 ways to cut back. A sugary beverage now and then is okay as a treat, but on a regular basis, the sugar rush is far too rapid for our bodies to handle. Here's some ways to cut down. 1. Swap sparkling water for sugary soda. Calorie-free seltzers come in an array of flavors. 2. Brew your own iced tea. Chill a pot of tea, then add just a touch of sweetener if you want. 3. Flavor up your H2O. Sliced fruit or calorie-free powders or drops add zing to plain water. 4. Snack on fruit. Replace juices with whole fruits, especially citrus fruits and berries. And 5. Don't drink away stress. If you need an energy rush, consider physical or mental exercise. And they've given a few examples here of the drinks. An 18-ounce sports drink has 31 grams of sugar. An 18-ounce smoothie, 36 grams of sugar. An 18-ounce sweet tea, 44 grams of sugar. An 18-ounce cola, 59 grams. And an 18-ounce lemonade is 60 grams of sugar. Now, we've been reading from The Complete Guide to Memory from Centennial Health. And today we're going to look at a chapter on hypnosis. You are getting very sleepy. While his hypnosis can prompt people to recall details they might not otherwise be able to bring up, the accuracy of those memories is far from guaranteed. A memory that is recovered through hypnosis may be no more accurate than any buried memory suddenly triggered after a period of time. And under hypnosis, some can temporarily suspend disbelief, allowing them to do things like lose confidence in gravity or forget the meaning of the number four. These were all little sidebar items here. Amir Raz sits next to a woman who is deep in a hypnotic trance. The concept of four, we're going to temporarily erase it from your mind, he tells her. Then he holds up both hands and asks her to count his fingers. 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The woman starts to giggle as she notices she's about to count past 10. 9, 10, 11, she finishes and laughs. What's going on, said Raz, a neuroscientist at Canada's McGill University who specializes in hypnosis and memory. You have 11 fingers, the woman giggles again. I obviously don't, right? He asks her to count just one hand, which yields a total of 6 fingers, despite clearly showing 5. How many wheels to a car? He asks. 3, comes the reply. How many wheels to a tricycle? He asks. 3, she says. Later, no longer under hypnosis, the woman tells an interviewer, I knew he had only 10 fingers. I knew logically there were 10, but when I went to count, I couldn't do it to save my life. Raz points to that video now because even though it was filmed 9 years ago, there's still so much that he and researchers don't understand about what happens in the brain to make it possible. I don't have a neuroscience way of verifying that she's forgotten the number four, he says. But if she had been in an fMRI scanner, a device that measures blood flow to specific regions of the brain to determine which areas are active and which are suppressed, he says he has an idea of what it might look like. I suspect I'm going to find particular areas like the anterior cingulate cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex lighting up. He knows the hypnotized brain will show a general pattern of inhibition on a scan, but beyond that, it's still a bit of a mystery as to why and how hypnosis, which has been used for centuries, works. Here's what scientists do know. When someone is in a hypnotic trance, their mind is in a state of intense, focused attention and trained so completely on the person guiding them that they're able to tune out nearly all other sensory cues. Not everyone is susceptible to hypnosis. It requires a certain combination of traits, including the ability to accept incongruities and a capacity for deep focus. In a hypnotized individual, the power of suggestion is so strong that it can prompt them to temporarily forget fundamental concepts that they have used and relied upon for decades, even concepts as deeply ingrained as the number four. For decades, particularly from the 60s through the 80s, researchers believed the inverse to be true as well. They thought that hypnosis could also help people remember. It can, but with a tall stack of caveats. There are basically 3 ways you can try to use hypnosis to influence memory, says Jean Roche Lawrence, a cognitive science researcher and university emeritus at Concordia University in Canada. Either you want people to forget, which is the amnesia that people may experience following hypnosis. You may talk about hyperamnesia, Are people who are hypnotized able to remember more than they would if they are not hypnotized? And then there's the whole issue of recovered memories and implementation of recovered memories, he says. Lawrence, who co-authored one of the foremost books on the convergence of hypnosis and law, Hypnosis, Will, and Memory, A Psycholegal History, has spent a lot of time investigating the accuracy of memories recounted while someone is under hypnosis. It was believed that when people were hypnotized, their memory became much more potent, much more powerful, and they could remember all kinds of things they couldn't remember when they weren't hypnotized, Lawrence says. But results from most studies looking into this were disappointing. There is one way, however, in which hypnosis can improve recall. Evidence suggests that the deeply focused state of mind of those under hypnosis may allow for improved recall of certain autobiographical details. In the first experiment to investigate this, published in the journal Science in 1983, researchers found that highly hypnotizable subjects were able to remember things they otherwise couldn't. There was a complication, however. For each accurate detail that someone recalled, they recalled four erroneous ones. The cost for that one memory was very high, Lawrence said. Whether that's a problem depends on the reason for recalling buried memories in the first place. When the approach is used for fact-finding missions, notably those of the law enforcement variety, the slope becomes particularly slippery. If you have one new piece of evidence, how do you differentiate between one that was correct and the four that aren't, he says. Lawrence and others began looking deeply and critically at the use of hypnosis in forensic investigations and concluded that it could be used for investigation, but not as evidence. In other words, someone under hypnosis might be able to provide potential clues worth pursuing, but not trial-worthy testimony. Memories can be useful without being entirely accurate, says Amanda Barnier, a cognitive scientist who specializes in memory and hypnosis. There's an assumption, especially in the forensic context, that people should be able to remember the past in exact detail, but they don't. Under hypnosis, they mostly get the gist of it right, but sometimes the details are not quite there, or they might misplace or misattribute certain things. It doesn't make it not useful or not meaningful, she says. Emphasis on the word meaningful, because in psychology, at least, meaning is the end game. If a trance can help someone better understand something about their lives or a relationship, or decrease fear and anxiety, if it can help someone find meaning in their past or their present, then most will deem it successful, whether or not a memory is accurate. As long as hypnosis is not being used for evidence or accusations, as long as one understands its revelations, may not be strictly accurate. It can be healing, indeed. If, in a clinical situation, I can harness the ability of hypnosis to make me believe really vividly in a moment in my mind, and that can change the way I think about or feel about or experience troubles, that's really, really powerful, Barnier says. A side comment, hypnosis is not a form of sleep. Someone in a hypnotic trance is deeply focused, but wide awake, able to hear, understand, and remember what was said afterwards. And we have another side article here. The problem with regression therapy, while memories may be false. Childhood abuse, particularly sexual abuse, can be so traumatizing that a child's brain will block it out so as to allow them to move on and handle day-to-day issues. Some people may abruptly remember such abuse as adults, but others just have an inkling there may be some trauma in their past. That's what prompts some to try a type of hypnosis known as regression therapy. The approach aims to help people resolve whatever long-standing concerns might be troubling them by guiding them back to a moment in their past. Yet, once you intervene with the memories of someone, you also take the chance that you will create memories that are false, and you won't be able to differentiate which is which, unless you succeed in independently corroborating with someone else, says Jean Roach Lawrence, a cognitive scientist researcher and professor emeritus at Concordia University in Canada. Indeed, though those memories may or may not be accurate, cognitive scientist Amanda Barnier says, someone who has been hypnotized can become inappropriately confident about them. Hypnosis can taint the memories. Not to say the memories are false, but that it's almost impossible to tell, she says. That's because memory is not set in stone, but something we reconstruct in accordance with how we see ourselves. In a sense, it's about coherence with our sense of identity, especially over time, as opposed to the actual reality of things. She points out that humans, by our very nature, try to make meaning out of things. Under hypnosis, the search for meaning persists and can permanently alter memories that are retrieved. Now, onto the Money Saver section of AARP, the magazine. Your next big housing decisions: buy or rent, move in with your child, get a roommate. Experts weigh in, and this is by Karen Hube. Decision number one, we are selling our house and planning to downsize into an apartment or condo. Should we buy or rent? Renting is often the best choice for folks in their 70s or older, not only from a financial perspective, but for practical and lifestyle reasons too, says Steve Parrish, co-director of the American College Center for Retirement Income. Buying can make sense if you don't have good rental options where you would like to live, and you have enough money to cover both the purchase price of the home and the ongoing costs of ownership. And buying comes with some possible financial benefits. Your new home might increase in value, for example. If you itemize deductions on your federal tax return, you can deduct your mortgage interest expense and up to $10,000 in property taxes and other state and local taxes. But the financial benefits of buying are often outweighed by drawbacks as you get older. A substantial amount of your wealth could be tied up in equity in the home. You would have to pay ongoing property taxes and home insurance, which could rise. The value of your home could fall, and you'll be on the hook to cover the costs of upkeep, repairs, and upgrades, costs that your landlord would otherwise have to pay for if you were renting. Note that when you sell your current place, you won't have to pay federal taxes on gains up to $500,000 for couples and $250,000 for singles. Retirees needing income can put proceeds into a fund or an annuity to live on, Parrish says. And having a landlord to deal with maintenance is great as you start getting physically challenged. Rental rates might go up, but so could homeowners' maintenance costs. Renting allows retirees to try something out and change course, adds Parrish. It's also great for spending summers and winters in different places without owning two homes. Would you be taking out a mortgage to buy your new place? Then the scale tips even further in favor of renting. Say you got a 30-year fixed-rate loan at the recent national average of about 6%. To offset the interest you're paying on the money tied up in your new home, you would need a return of at least 6% annually on your retirement investments, a high bar to clear. Now, this is decision number two. We are talking with our daughter about us paying to renovate and expand her home so we can move in with her and her family. Should we do this? This can be a great arrangement, says Roseanne Roget, a financial planner in Bohemia, New York. But there are personal and financial issues to think about in advance, she says. Tackle the personal issues first. Have an open, detailed conversation with your child and her spouse about lifestyle. Who will cook? How much babysitting will they expect? What will be your do not disturb hours? It's important to establish boundaries, says Ayla Giraud, a writer at agingimplace.org. Then address the finances. Figure out the cost of renovations. Write down in advance how much you will chip in for maintenance and utilities. Plan for what will happen if you need care later on. Your daughter may not want to be your primary caregiver. Finally, settle long-term ownership issues. Work with an attorney to specify what happens to the house if your daughter dies before you do. And if the home increases in value, will you be reimbursed if your daughter sells and moves on? And finally, is it a good idea to take in a boarder or a roommate to cut down on my housing expenses? Yes, as long as you take important steps to help avoid unpleasant scenarios such as the renter leaving messes, making noises after hours, causing property damage, not paying, or refusing to leave, says Aletha Kipps, an attorney, real estate broker, and gerontologist in San Francisco. To protect yourself, be sure to formalize the process, she says. Screen your tenants. Ask potential renters for references and permission to run a background check using their social security number. Tenant screening services offered by the major credit reporting agencies, Equifax and TransUnion, include both credit and criminal record checks. Your community may have roommate services that pre-screen renters. Some colleges have programs that place students with older residents. If there is a college nearby, this can be a great arrangement. Insist on a signed lease. Detail everything, from whether pets are permitted, how many visitors are allowed at one time, where parking is permitted, when rent is due, and how much time the renter will have to vacate if things don't work out. Be aware that local rental laws may preempt what's in your contract. If you don't have a separate apartment, state what areas of your house are to be shared. Consider hosting. Many older people are simplifying the process by becoming hosts through short-term rental services such as Booking.com, Airbnb, or Homestay. Check that short-term rentals are permitted where you live. I know a couple of seniors who've really enjoyed the social aspect. Mind your paperwork. When you weigh how much renting will help offset your expenses, remember that rental income, which is taxable, is ordinary income, must be reported to the IRS. Also keep in mind that rental laws may vary by state and even by municipality. Be sure the forms you use are specific to where you live. Despite her words of warning, renting can be a great way to offset expenses and come with social benefits. For every cautionary tale, there are many great rental stories. Now let's see what Jan Wenner, the founder and longtime editor of Rolling Stones magazine, has to say about Mick Jagger. I first met Mick Jagger when I was 22 and he was 25. It was in July 1968. Jane and I were on our honeymoon poolside with the Steve Miller Band at a hotel in Hollywood. Mick was in town remixing Beggar's Banquet with Glenn Johns, who was also producing Steve's record. Mick had a soft handshake and a soft voice. He was wearing a dress shirt with pressed trousers, definitely not a rock star outfit. But a rock star he surely was. He made me feel comfortable right away. I sat at the mixing board between Glenn and Mick, and suddenly out of the supersonic sound system came Street Fighting Man. They played it again and again as they mixed it. Stunning on first listen, absolutely incredible as the song became more familiar. They also worked on No Expectations. Then Mick stopped the mixing and told me he had finished one more, and would I like to hear it? It was Sympathy for the Devil. The final take had been done the day after Bobby Kennedy had been gunned down, and Mick added the lines, "I shouted out, 'Who killed the Kennedys?' After all, it was you and me." Mick took me in his red Cadillac convertible to the house he had rented in Beverly Hills, where he had the test pressing of a new record to play for me that had knocked him out. It was the first time I heard music from Big Pink, the debut album by the band. We spent a long time talking about music and so many other things. It was a great start to a friendship. And now Bob Dylan. I met Bob at the Stanhope Hotel on East 81st Street and Fifth Avenue. He was clean cut, neatly dressed, and carried a book bag. He came alone. This was in those less fraught early days without PR people. His answers were simple and direct. If Bob didn't want to answer, he wasn't evasive. but he would just stay silent until I felt completely awkward and then moved on. "Well, Jan," he said, "I'll tell you. I was on the road for almost 5 years. It wore me down. I was on drugs, a lot of things. A lot of things just to keep going. And I don't want to live that way anymore. I'm just waiting for a better time." Do you think you've played any role in the change of popular music in the last 4 years?
I hope not.
Well, a lot of people say you have. Well, you know, I'm not one to argue. I don't want to make anyone worry about it, but boy, if I could ease someone's mind, I would be the first one to do it. I want to lighten every load, straighten out every burden. I don't want anybody to be hung up, especially over me or anything I do. Now we're going to continue with some money-saving tips, and we're looking at travel these days. Choose no-car-needed vacations. Car rental companies depleted their fleets during the COVID-19 pandemic, and now they're struggling to replenish due to a shortage of semiconductor chips. As a result, rental fees have soared beyond the inflation rate. Fly into cities that have good public transportation, such as San Francisco, New York, Chicago, or Boston. If you're looking for a more secluded getaway, go to a mostly car-free island, such as Mackinac Island, Michigan, or Catalina Island, California. Save on airfare and hotels. Check out fares to airports that are an hour or two from the one closest to your destination. If you can save, say, $100 per person, we'll be renting a car anyway, it might be worth the extra time and gas. Book hotels last minute if you can. For example, if you're planning a road trip and you're flexible about where to stay, you'll save an average of 13% by booking 2 weeks in advance rather than 4 months. And don't pay resort fees. About 40% of luxury hotels now charge these fees for facilities like pools or concierge services, which average about $25 per night. Look for lodging without the extra charge at resortfeechecker.com. Another tactic to avoid these fees, book with hotel loyalty points. Hilton Honors and World of Hyatt are among the loyalty programs that often waive resort fees. And these helpful hints came from AARP The Bulletin and the cover story, 99 Great Ways to Save. And we are making our way through. We're currently on number 27. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.